You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1995 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Timothy Whitaker titled Paul and Timothy in Ephesus.
We identified in the last few verses of Ephesians chapter 1 one of those difficult phrases that baffles us so frequently in Paul's writings. And this phrase in chapter 1 and verse 21, all principality and power, is the phrase to which I propose we devote our attention for the next hour. The word principality is usually translated beginning. There's an example of that in Colossians 1 where we read, he is the head of the church who is the beginning, the firstborn. And the word powers is usually translated power in the sense of authority. Think of this example from Matthew 9, the Son of Man hath power on earth to forgive sins. It's obviously Jesus saying that he has the authority to do it. John chapter 1, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. This is the authority that was given us. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, where Paul writes to the Corinthians, have we not power to eat and drink? He means we have the authority to decide to do that. But when the phrase principality and powers comes together, this is a special phrase with a special meaning. Let's turn to Titus chapter 3. Titus chapter 3 and verse 1, Paul writes, put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to magistrates, to obey magistrates, to be ready to every good work. And in its context, principality and powers in Titus 3 verse 1 seems definitely to be the civil authorities. Now I ask you to come back to Luke chapter 12. Luke's Gospel chapter 12, and there we will look at verse 11. Jesus warned us, verse 11 of Luke 12. And when they bring you unto the synagogues and unto magistrates and powers, take ye no thought how or what thing ye shall answer or what ye shall say. Now in that verse 11, the phrase magistrates and powers is identical to the phrase principalities and powers, which we're considering in the epistles. And in its context here, it's very obvious, isn't it, that principalities and powers means rulers and authorities. And if you happen to have a revised version, you'll find that that's exactly what that says. Rulers and authorities. We're talking about civil authorities, aren't we? Turn over a few pages, chapter 20. Luke 20 and verse 20. And they watched him and sent forth spies which should feign themselves just men, that they might take hold of his words, that so they might deliver him unto the power and authority of the governor. And that phrase is very obvious, isn't it? The power and authority. It's the principality and power. It's the same phrase. But in its context of the governor, it's very obvious that this is about civil authorities. Now this might look, brethren and sisters, like a uniform way to understand the terms principalities and powers. But when we apply this approach that these three passages have given us to the passages in Ephesians and in Colossians, we really get ourselves into difficulties. You see what I mean? If you'll come with me, please, to Colossians 2 and the section beginning at verse 14. We're going to spend now a few minutes looking at this section in Colossians chapter 2, from verse 14 to verse 17. Look at this carefully. Verse 14. Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. Now that's obviously something that Jesus did. We're reading about Jesus, verse 15, and having spoiled principalities and powers, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it. And then the section goes on to say, let no man therefore judge you in a whole series of things. Verse 17, things which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ. Now, coming back to verse 15, and particularly this phrase, having spoiled principalities and powers, and noticing that it's by his death, it's nailing it to his cross, we ask the question, did Jesus spoil human authorities by his death? And if we think about that, the answer has to be no. The spoiling of human authorities by Christ is something which is still future. We're waiting for it. We know it'll happen at the second coming, don't we? Looking again at this verse 15. Triumphing over them in it by his cross. Does this fit the high priest, Caiaphas, or Herod, or Pilate? Did Jesus triumph over them by his cross? This is the sense of triumphing over principalities and powers. Was it not the resurrection rather than the cross which gave the triumph? You see what I mean when I say we've got a bit of difficulty in this passage. If we start reading civil authorities here for principalities and powers. In fact, is it not odd that Paul should pick out this aspect of Christ's death and emphasize this here in this section of the scripture, which is really almost an insignificant matter? Let's have a look at the context. Cast your eye back to verse 14. Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances. What's that? Look at verse 16, context again. Verse 16, let no man therefore judge you in meat, that's in your food you eat, in drink, in respect of an holy day, or of the new moon, or of the Sabbath day. And what are all these things but aspects of the law? Now you hook that together, the phrase in verse 14 about handwriting of ordinances, and all these things in verse 16, they're obviously the law of Moses. Now where does this language, before and after, about the law of Moses fit with an understanding of principalities of powers about civil authorities? It just doesn't fit at all, does it? All right. If we read the Revised Version, back at verse 15, Revised Version. Having put off from himself the principalities and powers. Well, the linguists tell us that that is an accurate translation of the words. And if some of you are using a more modern version, you'll probably find particularly New King James, will take that, having put off from himself the principalities and powers. It's reminiscent of, ye have put off the old man, same sort of expression, which comes in chapter 3 of this letter to the Colossians. But it doesn't enlighten us anything about the meaning. After thinking about that phrase that way, you're no wiser, are you? No wiser at all. You look at the Revised Version margin, and it's no help. All it does is to introduce a statement, because it says, having put off from himself his body. And you read that and you say, but that's wrong doctrine. So that's rubbish. We can discount that completely. The RV margin is definitely no help to us there. But we're not getting very far with this passage in Colossians, are we? But one thing at least we have established. To read principalities and powers in this passage as being about civil authorities gives us nothing but problems. Can we put that in the fridge for a while and turn back a few pages to Ephesians chapter 3? Look at another of these passages. Ephesians 3, and this time, please, I'd like us to look at the section beginning at verse 8. Ephesians 3, and the section is from verse 8 to verse 11. Unto me, writes Paul, Ephesians 3, verse 8. Unto me, who am less than the least of all saints, is this grace given, that I should preach among the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery, which from the beginning of the world hath been hid in God, who created all things by Jesus Christ, to the intent that now unto the principalities and powers in heavenly places might be known by the church the manifold wisdom of God according to the eternal purpose which he purposed in Christ. Now, if principalities and powers in this passage are civil authorities, what are they doing in heavenly places? Which is what the verse says there in verse 10. So this approach leads to rather obvious duplication. If we make heavenly places, like some people do, mean positions of authority, because that would mean that verse 10 was saying, to the intent that now unto civil rulers in positions of authority. And he's rather repeating himself. And to what point? Now, in fact, the phrase in heavenly places usually means in heaven. Cast your eye back onto the previous page, end of chapter 1, in the phrase where we finished yesterday. Chapter 1, verse 20. Raised him from the dead and set him at his own right hand in the heavenly places. And it's obvious, isn't it, brethren and sisters? In heavenly places there means in heaven. And that's what it means here in chapter 3. Have a look at Ephesians 2. And verse 5, even when we were dead in sins, hath quickened us together with Christ, by grace ye are saved, and hath raised us up together and made us sit together in heavenly places in Christ. And this is the concept of us being in heaven, raised up to sit together with him in heavenly places. This passage describes the parallel between the experience of Christ and that of his church. He died, we died with him in baptism. He rose, we rose to newness of life. He ascended to heaven to sit at God's right hand. We did the same and are with him there in heaven, in a specialized sense. This series of events all follows because baptism is, of course, by faith. And all the other things follow by faith also. This, in chapter 2, verses 5 and 6, is the divine view of our position with the Lord. Now let's come back to Colossians chapter 3, where you get similar terms. Colossians 3 and verse 3. It's just like what we've looked at in Ephesians 2. Colossians 3 and verse 3. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. It's the idea of being heaven. So sit together in heavenly places back in Ephesians chapter 2 needs to be taken literally in that context. It's the idea of us with him there, because it's all part of our conviction by faith that we are with Christ and we are going to be with him in eternity when he sets up his kingdom in the age to come down here. Now let's come back to this problem passage in Ephesians 3. Ephesians 3 and verse 10. If principalities and powers means civil authorities, did Paul, who's picked out in verse 8 by the words, unto me, preach so much to civil authorities? Well, we can recall Gallio in Corinth, can't we? We can think of Felix and Festus in Caesarea and Agrippa when he was imprisoned there. But who else among civil authorities might we consider that Paul preached to? Oh yes, we might add the Jewish Sanhedrin at the same time as these men in Caesarea. We might guess that Nero perhaps completes the list at the end of Paul's 2 years waiting in his own hired house for the hearing in Rome. But brethren and sisters, really, is this witnessing before civil authorities a significant part of Paul's work? So that he could write, now unto the principalities and powers in heavenly places might be known by the church the wisdom of God. Does this seem a fair assessment of the important part of Paul's work of witnessing for Christ over so many years? Don't you think that that idea, interpreting principalities and powers there as about civil authorities, really puts the whole of Paul's witnessing completely out of proportion? It does, doesn't it? Look at the main point in this statement. Verse 8. Unto me. What's his main point in these words? He says, in effect, unto me is this grace given. What for? To preach among the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ and to make all men see the hidden divine wisdom. Why? To the intent that it might now be made evident to civil authorities. Is that the gist of it? Slimming it down to one sentence? That's not satisfactory, is it? We really have got problems if we try and read principalities and powers as civil authorities in this passage. We've got to do better than that. Well, let's put that one in the fridge as well. Turn over the page, please, and let's come to chapter 6. Chapter 6 and verse 12. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Now notice, please, that this verse 12 begins, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. We all know that flesh and blood is a Bible way of saying human nature. So it's not human people that we're wrestling against. He says, not that kind. It's principalities and powers. Yet principalities and powers, if they're civil authorities, certainly are human nature, aren't they? So we can't read civil authorities here for principalities and powers. And in any case, we've learned that this phrase, heavenly places, needs to be read literally. And the principalities and powers, if they're civil authorities, they're certainly not in heaven. We've got difficulties with this verse as well, haven't we? These difficulties really are piling up in the letter to the Ephesians and in the letter to the Colossians. If we take them as meaning civil authorities, we're just running ourselves into difficulty. What can I tell you? That Christian writings, soon after the first century, used the phrase principalities and powers as a term for angels. Now we'll think about that as we go forward. Let's proceed by turning to Romans chapter 8. We're right at the end of Romans chapter 8. Last two verses. Verse 38. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ. Now there is one thing you will notice in this passage. That we've got principalities and powers side by side with angels. Yes, I agree with you. It is difficult to explain why there seems to be a repetition, unless he's trying to emphasize it. But we can at least say one thing after reading this passage, that principalities and powers are associated with angels in this verse. Even if we say no more, they are at least associated. Can we bear that in mind as we proceed? 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter 3 and verse 22. It's the last verse of the chapter again. It's talking about Christ. 1 Peter 3, 22. Who is gone into heaven and is on the right hand of God. Angels and authorities and powers being made subject unto him. Now that word authorities is the same word as principalities that we've been looking at in Ephesians and Colossians. And the word powers is the word dunamis, which Brother John took us to on Monday evening, if you recall. Dunamis, we learned dynamite. That's same word in our language today. And it is an obvious alternative for the usual word for principalities that we've got in our phrase. So when we read here, angels and authorities and powers, in the terms of Colossians and Ephesians, we're reading angels and powers and a word like principalities. Now again, notice the emphasis. Christ has gone into heaven, says the verse. He's sitting at the right hand of God, and these are made subject to him. They weren't subject to him before. They are made subject to him. This is a bit like the language in Hebrews chapter 1 that I'm sure you can all remember. Let me recall it for you. He sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high, being made. So much better than the angels. It's an exact parallel, isn't it? Made better than the angels. It's part of the authority given to Christ, the writer to the Hebrews is saying. 1 Peter chapter 3 is saying. We are perhaps beginning to build a picture of principalities and powers as meaning angels. Let's come to Colossians chapter 2. This was our first problem passage where we ran into trouble. Colossians 2 and verse 14. Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances. We said, yes, that passage is about the law. Now, remember how the Jews used to think about their law. We don't have to guess this. This is something that Scripture tells us, what the Jewish people thought about their law. I'm going to give you three quick examples that I'm sure you'll be familiar with. The first one from Acts 7 is where Stephen said, just think about it, "You who have received the law by the disposition of angels and have not kept it." He rounded on them. You notice the association between the giving of the law and angels. Or Galatians chapter 3, where Paul wrote, "The law was ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator." Or as a third example, Hebrews chapter 2. "For if the word spoken by angels was steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward," there also, part of the power of the argument to the readers of each of those passages, or the hearers in the Acts 7 case, was that the Jews felt that their law had been, as it were, personally delivered, personally handed over by angels, and their reverence for that law was particular because they saw it in that particular way. Each of these three writers reminded Jews, or those influenced by them, that the powers of the law to a Jew arose from its being given through angels. Colossians 2 verse 15. This language about having put off from himself. So Christ putting off from himself the principalities and powers is Jesus being subject unto the law during his lifetime, but doing away with it by his death. That's what the verse says. Having spoiled principalities and powers. What he'd done, he'd nailed it to his cross. We read of Jesus elsewhere, he was born under the law. Yes, he was, but he wasn't under the law now. He's risen above it. He has done away with it. You see, the point now of this passage, in its overall context, the purpose of this is not so for Christ's followers now. Not so. Just as Christ has done away with the law, so Christ's followers can do away with it. And you look at the next verse, and that's exactly what you read. Verse 16. "Let no man judge you." The law doesn't apply in meat, drink, holy days, new moons, Sabbaths. All those things from the law of Moses, these things don't apply now, says Paul. And here's a practical point, that he is obviously meaning these Colossian brethren to take the message, "Don't listen, brethren, to anybody who tells you that these things from the law do apply. Don't listen to them." And there were plenty. We had hints of it yesterday, didn't we? Plenty of Judaizing brethren. I called them the heavy gang, didn't I? They'd come in and they'd thump away at the importance of the law. And here is a point in Colossians 2, where he has argued very carefully, and the conclusion is, don't listen to anybody who tells you that they should be following the law. Now we get the same point, if you'd like to flick back a few pages, in Galatians 3 and verse 13. Galatians 3 verse 13, "Christ hath redeemed us from the curse of the law." Well, look again, back in Colossians 2, at the context. Colossians 2 and verse 18. Verse 18, "Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshipping of angels." That word worshipping is the word for religious rituals, all the things Jews were jolly good at. It's the word that Paul uses in Acts 26 when he stood up there in front of that great crowd and witnessing about his early life, he said, after the straitest sect of our religion, our rituals, I lived a Pharisee. This word here in verse 18, worshipping of angels, religious rituals of angels, it's a way of saying law of Moses. So when we reread the whole of this section in Colossians chapter 2, it is telling us Christ was no longer subject to the law from the moment of his death. So why should we be subject to it? That is what this difficult passage is about. Now let's come to the second of our problems, which is in Ephesians chapter 3. Ephesians chapter 3, brethren and sisters, in which we found so many difficulties, now becomes a profound statement about the purpose of God. Look again at the phrase in verse 10. To the intent, this is the purpose of God, to the intent that now to the angels in heaven might be known through the church, revised version, through the church, that word through I think is worth underlining, the wisdom of God. This is Ephesians 3 and verse 10. I just repeat the point, to the intent that now to the angels in heaven might be known through the church the wisdom of God. What's he saying? This wisdom is being revealed, he's saying, to angels. Because they see God's great plan being preached and made clear to believers in the church. You see, it says, through the church. There are the angels, and they're looking down, and they're seeing all these things happening in the church, and they're saying, I say, isn't this terrific? That's the point. That's what the passage is telling us. That's the picture that we're meant to get. It means, brethren and sisters, that Paul's great work with the gospel was a revelation to angels. It was a great educational experience for angels. That's what this passage is telling us. You begin to understand why he calls it, verse 10, the manifold wisdom of God. You begin to understand why in verse 8 he calls it the unsearchable riches of Christ. We may not understand it all, but we can marvel at it, can't we? The idea that angels are looking down there at what's going on among us in the ecclesias, and they're saying, isn't this just wonderful? These people are being transformed by the gospel, and this is all God's great plan, and it's just working out. And there they are looking down at us, and they're marveling at this. Now we've got something to marvel at. This is just something terrific. We may not fully understand it, but it is a picture, brethren and sisters, that really can thrill us. I hope you've got a grasp on that this morning. I hope you feel that the gist of this passage at least is something you can dwell on another day when you've got time to yourself. And even if you don't fully understand the ramifications of it, you can at least marvel at it. That this is one of the wonderful things of God's plan. You'll actually find that the gist of this Ephesians 3 passage is similar to 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 12. Remember that phrase there where it says, the angels desire to look into. And the things in verse 10 of 1 Peter 1 that the angels were desiring to look into, there are two of them. One of them is the sufferings of Christ, and the other, the glory that should follow. So there is another passage in roughly the same mold. Angels looking into things, like I said, and marveling at what they see. The sufferings of Christ, they only see the consequence of that in ourselves, and the glory that should follow, the ultimate for us. Well, that's the Ephesians 3 passage. Now let's turn over the page, please, to Ephesians 6 and look at our third problem passage. Ephesians 6 and verse 12. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. Well, if it's not human nature we're wrestling against, what is it? It's principalities and powers. The case so far would suggest that we've got to read this as being angels. And then the next phrase in the verse is the rulers of the darkness of this world. Rulers of the darkness of this world. The revised version says the world rulers of this darkness. Now this word translated world rulers, the Talmud uses for the angel of death. And the Septuagint uses the phrase Lord world ruler for Lord of hosts. And you and I, when we read Lord of hosts in books like Zechariah and so on, our minds in a flash interpret that to ourselves as Lord God of hosts of angels, don't we? So here we've got the Septuagint using Lord world ruler, which is this word, for Lord of hosts, which we think of as angels. The phrase then becomes angels of this darkness. And then there's another phrase also in this verse 12. Against spiritual wickedness. Now literally, that's spiritual ones of evil. This very closely resembles a phrase that I made a passing reference to yesterday morning in our study, a phrase in Psalm 78 and verse 49, a phrase which most of us tend to jump over very quickly. It's there in very clear black and white in the revised version where we read about angels of evil in relation to all the plagues that God wrought in Egypt. Now remember, like I brought to you yesterday, Hebrews chapter 1 says, of angels are they not all ministering spirits? So the one thing we do is we absolutely rule out that there are any wicked angels. There are no wicked angels. All are under God's control. All are doing his work. Hebrews 1, are they not all ministering spirits? And yet, here in Psalm 78, we've got this phrase about the angels who brought about the plagues in Egypt being angels of evil. And here in Ephesians 6:12, we've got this phrase, rulers of the darkness of this world and spiritual wickedness, spiritual ones of evil. It's obviously harping back to the Psalm language about angels who have to do a work, plagues, that not one of us would enjoy. Every one of us would be groaning under the evil of it. And yet there we would see it. Once we came to our senses as something that God was in control of. God was doing because he knows best. He needed to shake us with experience of evil. I know we've already been in Exodus 12 this morning, but can we go back to it very quickly again? Because I want you to see this in black and white on the paper. Exodus 12 and verse 23, because you know this passage. Exodus 12 and verse 23, for the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians. So there's going to be an angel go through Egypt. And when he seeth the blood upon the lintel and the two side posts, the Lord will pass over. Hence our expression, Passover feast. Because the Lord passed over the house. That's what the verse is saying. The Lord will pass over the door. It's the angel over the house, protecting the faithful Israelite who has put the sign on the door, the blood on the sideposts and the lintel. Isn't it? And the verse finishes that this, the Lord passing over the door, will not suffer the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. So out there, there's another angel, and he's called the destroyer. You've got two lots busy. Those who are preserving the faithful, protecting the house, the word literally means hover, and out there, you've got the destroyer, who's going through Egypt and slaying the firstborn in all directions. Now that is a powerful passage, isn't it? Demonstrating to us that these two types are indeed at work on certain occasions, both at God's behest, some doing what we see as a good work, some as an evil work. And the other passage that I really do want you to look at is Isaiah 31. Because this is obviously based on the one we've just looked at in Exodus. And it's the very same word in the Hebrew. It's the word Pasach. And I'm amazed Ronald hasn't actually told us about Pasach. Because when I'm reading in the Jerusalem Post, they seem these days to spell it Pesach. And it took me years to realize that they were talking about Passover time. This is the word clearly that is still being used today. Isaiah 31 and verse 5. As birds flying, so will the Lord of hosts defend Jerusalem. Defending, also he will deliver it. And, here's your word, passing over. It's the hovering, the protection from the angel. Passing over, he will preserve it. There's the angel doing his good work as we see it. We get this also in How Long Halt Ye Between Two Opinions in 1 Kings chapter 18 when Elijah was on the top of Mount Carmel. How long halt ye? How long are you hovering like a bird? You're neither going that way nor going that way. You're just stuck there in the middle. And you won't make your mind. You're hovering like a kestrel, said Elijah. And it's the same idea. But here we've got it particularly in relation to this defending action. Now, in this passage in Ephesians 6, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. Do we wrestle against angels, brethren and sisters? Wrestling against angels? Straight away, your minds are ticking, aren't they? And you're back in Genesis 32. Let's have a look at that. Genesis 32 is, of course, the story of Jacob, and he's come back from the hard labor under Laban, his uncle, and he's on the border of the land, isn't he? Genesis 32, and he's getting very nervous. He's like you and me on a bad day, nearly worrying ourselves into a gastric ulcer. Just what we shouldn't be doing. Verse 10, well, at least he starts out trying to tackle it in the right way. Genesis 32 and verse 10, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Verse 11, deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. Well, he's praying fervently. But having prayed, he's still worrying. Verse 12, and thou saidst, surely I will do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea. He's reminding God of his promises, just in case he'd forgotten. Verse 14, he puts together 200 she-goats, 20 he-goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, some milch camels, colts, kine, bulls, she-asses, foals. What a list. Verse 16, we read that he sent these out in droves. And more than that, last phrase of verse 16, he put a space between drove and drove. This is Jacob wrestling with all the difficulties in life. He's really got his wits going, his brain's revving at full speed, and he's thinking of everything that he can do to soften up his brother. And he's sending all these presents, but he's spacing them out very carefully in the hope that perhaps they'll make enough impact to turn Esau into jelly, soften him up, and make him pliable. It's human thinking, isn't it? He's wrestling with the circumstances of his life. Verse 20, second half of the verse, I will appease him with the present that goeth before me, and afterward I will see his face. And then verse 24, and Jacob was left alone. And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And it's as if the chapter is telling us Jacob had been wrestling all his life. He just spent several hours wrestling like mad, trying to think of everything he could. And even now in the gloom at nightfall, somebody suddenly turns up and it's as if he thinks it's Esau himself, using subterfuge to try and get at him. And that's the way he's behaving. Wrestles with the man. And it's only when this man, verse 25, saw that he prevailed not against him, that he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint, and he wrestled with him. And do you know, from that day to his dying day, Jacob was a cripple, and he probably needed at least one good stout stick. It took all that to stop this man of God from wrestling against the circumstances of life. And it took all this, brethren and sisters, to bring home to him that he had been wrestling against God's angels all those years. And we're wrestling. Our passage in Ephesians says we're not wrestling with humans. We're wrestling with angels like Jacob did. Do we need to wrestle with angels? Can't we learn from Jacob? Now look at the context back in Ephesians 6. And you'll find in verse 11 that the context talks about standing against the wiles of the devil. And who's your devil that you're standing against? Isn't it your internal battle? Use the armor of God, says verse 11. The armor of God is the armor God gives you. Like David, when he took on Goliath, David trusted. He used what skills he had and God did the rest. But before he put on that armor of God, David said, the Lord delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear. He will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. That was real trust. And so things went right. God took control. Look again at the context that's in front of you. And in verse 13, you'll see he goes on to say that ye may be able to withstand. Mark that word, withstand. In the evil day. He goes on and he says, and having done all, to stand. And then verse 14, stand therefore. There's no striving in this picture, is there? There's no wrestling here. You put on your armor and you stand, says the apostle. Reliance on God is what you want. Stand there, accept God's control, and God will look after it all for you. That's the message. And that is what faithless folk like you and me on a bad day desperately need, isn't it? That's the policy we need. That's the way we ought to be behaving. Consider the contrast with the life of Jacob prior to the day when he wrestled with the angel. All wrestling. Paul's point is, don't be wrestling with angels, brethren. They're there to minister to you. Let God take control. Let his angels do it all. They will. The perseverance, then, is in the prayer. And the prayer is in verse 18 of this context. The prayer is also supplication. And what do you supplicate for? You ask, first of all, for the saints. And you ask, says Paul in verse 19, secondly, for me. And the final passage I want to bring you is in Ephesians chapter 1. at his own right hand in the heavenlies, far above all principalities and powers and might and dominion, a rabbi's phrase for orders of angels. So there's Jesus, far above all the angels, far above all the orders of angels, far above every name. Hebrews 1, unto which of the angels said he at any time, thou art my son? Or again, when he bringeth in the firstborn into the world, he saith, and let all the angels of God worship him. Of the angels, he saith, who maketh his angels spirits and his ministers a flame of fire. Are they not all ministering spirits? See, all those passages in Hebrews 1 tally with the passage in Ephesians 1 and verse 20 about Jesus being above angels from his death onwards. All these passages demonstrate his superiority over angels. He is now in control. And we have got to try desperately hard not to struggle, not to wrestle, but to accept this control over angels. God knows best. Please, brethren, let this be our policy from day to day. Let's put the worrying in the waste paper basket.